You're listening to Beyond the Ribbon, a podcast of the Cancer Survivorship Center, powered by 24 Hours in the Canyon. This podcast is brought to you by Auto Inc. Auto Inc. is a distinguished family of dealerships redefining automotive excellence. Be sure to check out their website at autoinc.com. Hey everyone, welcome to this episode of Beyond the Ribbon. My name is Ryan Parnell, and as always, I'm joined by my co-host and oncology nurse, Pam McMillan.
Ryan, this is an exciting podcast to have.
It is very exciting, Pam. But let's tell our listeners why.
Well, you know, we're in our new building.
Yes.
A new space.
Yes.
We have a new guest.
Yes.
So I think it's going to be exciting to be here. I hope people will stop by, learn about us. You know, we have lots of things to offer.
That's right. That's right. You know, for a little over a year now, we've been anxiously awaiting this new facility located at 1732 Hagee Boulevard. Mm-hmm. It's next door to the Junior League House of Amarillo, and it's kind of a little across the street from the Botanical Gardens.
Right.
And man, what a place this is.
Yes. You know, whenever you had your kids, did they come with a manual?
No.
Don't you wish you had a manual sometimes?
Yes.
You know, you had to keep up with the vaccines and you had to make sure they had their wellness visits. Sometimes as adults, I think that we forget what we need to go get screened.
Yeah, there's a lot, right?
Yeah.
And it changes.
It changes. Guidelines change. So, you know, it's always great to refresh on what we should be going to the doctor for, keeping up with our general screenings, and then just being healthy.
Yeah. And so it's always a good time to revisit that. And here we are at the end of the year, right? So the beginning of the year is always a good time to kind of maybe refresh and think about things to do better maybe next year, or get scheduled, get on the calendar. So what a perfect time to introduce our guest and jump right in as we talk about screenings and cancer screenings. Dr. Rodney Young is joining us today. Dr. Young is a professor and chairman of the Department of Family and Community Medicine at Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center here in Amarillo. He maintains a very active clinical practice at Texas Tech, in addition to his teaching and administrative responsibilities, and is a leader in local and regional medical organizations. And he's been on our board, and we thank Dr. Young for taking time out of your clinical practice and teaching abilities today to come and join us on our podcast.
I'm really happy to be here. One of the cool things about my job in academics is that I teach students, I teach residents, I teach others, but a part of that is also participating in the community, helping to spread the word and teach others. And that's an aspect of it I really enjoy.
Right. Before anybody freaks out, you said you're a professor, you're going to teach medical students, and we're going to dumb this down for some of our folks so that we all understand and we're not overwhelmed, correct?
In the world I live in, I'm a primary care physician. So part of the street cred of primary care is learning how to speak the language that people speak and translate medical concepts into plain language. So like anyone, I might mess that up from time to time. I might get away from myself in doing it. But the reality is that learning to, you know, say things that perhaps some of their other doctors might have said to them that kind of went over their head, and translate that to meaningful terms, that goes a long way in primary care and helping patients navigate the healthcare system. So I'll try to do that.
I'm sure you're going to do a great job. You know, whenever patients go to the doctor, sometimes it's they forget what they hear. And so having someone there to listen and understand is also great. So get out your notebooks. We're going to give you some guidelines to follow. So let's just start with the basics, screenings. Where would you like to take us on screenings for women? Are there certain ones that we should be doing at certain ages?
Yeah, there's a lot of different things. So if you're comfortable with it, since this is a survivorship podcast,
yes,
let's talk about cancer screenings first off. And so when you talk about women, probably the most prominent thing that comes to mind is breast cancer screening.
Yep.
as the sort of the most prominent ribbon out there, so to speak. So the breast cancer screening recommendations have actually evolved a little bit in recent years. So we've had we've historically had a little bit of a difference in the recommendations from different societies. And probably right off the top here, it's important for us to understand that there's different recommendations out there. There's a spectrum. So typically speaking, what you might hear about on the news, on the one hand, you'll have the government entities. So in the United States, you'll hear about the United States Preventive Services Task Force. There's a Canadian Preventive Services Task Force. And then most of the westernized countries of the world that provide health care to their residents, they'll have a government entity. For example, in the United Kingdom, it's commonly referred to as NICE, which is short for the National Institute for Health and Clinical Excellence.
Oh.
They create the guidelines that the UK's medical system follows for screening. In general, when it's a governmental entity that's making the recommendation, they will have a very high evidence threshold. Like, there has to be very compelling evidence that an intervention is beneficial and acceptable to patients, something they can afford and are willing to engage in. So in the large systems like the UK, where it's socialized, they're making a decision about what we're willing to pay for. In the United States, where we have a variety of different payers, there's a factor in, like, will they be willing to pay for this or not? Is it a sufficiently useful intervention? So if it's coming from a governmental entity, it tends to have a high evidence bar. And that's not to say that the specialty societies and the various disease-specific organizations don't also have, you know, strong evidence thresholds. It's just to understand that they live in a world where they're fully immersed in that specific disease content all the time. They interact with people who have those things. They're their friends and neighbors. And so that group of individuals tends to make a more aggressive recommendation. Like, we think we should start even earlier, screen more often, those sorts of things. And there's not a right or wrong in either one of those spectrums. The most important message, if you hear nothing else today, it is to get screened, have an approach and do that regularly. But this is the space where you can have a conversation about what's the best strategy, because we're all a little bit different. Some people have higher risk coming into the conversation. And most of these recommendations that we'll discuss today, what we're talking about is average risk screening. So a person who doesn't have a mom or a sister or a daughter who's had breast cancer, or they don't have multiple relatives or anyone in their family who, God forbid, had bilateral breast cancer, those things can all change the lens through which you view the disease process.
So what I'm hearing is, and I assume our listeners are hearing, now I understand why it's so confusing.
It's a one size fits all. It's multiple.
It would be nice if, you know, you could say breast cancer, here's what you do, the mm-hmm. end. Mm-hmm. And if we had just one organization that issued recommendations, we would. But there's room for that. There are patients who come to see me. So, for example, one of the things that's been in the press recently is that the government's entity, the United States Preventive Services Task Force, used to recommend breast cancer have mammography every 2 years between the ages of 50 and 75.
Right.
While at the same time, several different specialty societies, so perhaps the most notable, the American College of Radiologists, the doctors that interpret mammography, they have said you should have annual mammography, you should begin at age 40. Well, that's a considerable difference. A woman in her lifetime who followed the government's prior recommendation might have 12 or 13 mammograms, whereas a person who followed the American College of Radiology's recommendation might have 30 or 40 mammograms. So there's quite a lot of difference in how much healthcare you're taking on and what might be the possible benefits and what might be the possible risks. So with mammography specifically, an excellent screening test with a lot of information around it. So the data have tended to say that we're seeing more breast cancer in the 40s, more clinically significant breast cancer for women in their 40s. And so now that evidence threshold has been met, the Preventive Services Task Force is now in line with most of the specialty groups and say, you really should begin this at age 40. Where there's still some variability in there, is that the Preventive Services Task Force says start at age 40 if you're at average risk, and then probably do it about every 2 years over that lifespan, and that by age 75, you should probably stop routine screening if you haven't encountered anything by that. Now, several of the other groups will say I don't know. I wouldn't put an expiration date on a woman's life at age 75. It depends on the person who's sitting before you. So if that person is already suffering from heart disease or a number of different medical conditions that make it unlikely that you're going to be talking to them 10 years from now, then the benefit of mammography is quite small and the risk is quite high because you could introduce them into more surgical procedures, more radiation, and other things that they might not be able physically to tolerate. And so the benefit tends to diminish later in the screening recommendation interval. And that's why the government says probably after 75, you've gotten just about everything you're likely to benefit from this. The other thing we know is that the older you get, the more likely you are to find a breast cancer, but the less likely that breast cancer is at the end of that interval to ultimately be the thing that leads to your demise. And so there's a term we use that can be a little complicated, but we use the term overdiagnosis, which is you can find something, you can give it a name, a label, a treatment strategy, but if you had had a crystal ball and done nothing, it turns out that disease wasn't actually destined to harm you. And so for most of us, if a disease is never going to affect our lives, we'd rather not know about it. We'd rather go along and live happily and do whatever it is we do. And
absolutely. So what about our survivors that have had breast cancer? They follow a different guideline then.
Yeah, this conversation about screening is about average risk screening. Mm-hmm. So if you've had breast cancer, we're not talking specifically to you about how do you get average risk screening for that disease state. So yeah, you want to work with your oncologist, or if they've released you back to the care of your primary care physician, then you want to work with them on their recommended screening intervals, because your story is a different story than the average risk screening story that we're talking about.
You know, Ryan, that brings up communication, right?
Oh, absolutely. That word, Dr. Young, tends to pop up in 99% of our podcasts, of communication with the provider, communication with your family, communication in all facets. But in this particular, Pam, I can think of one other thing that would be very vital when the survivor transitions back to their primary care is what you provide to those survivors in the treatment summary and their care plan that they can then share with their physician to say, here's all my stuff. Here's all the nuts and bolts of what I had.
You know, and that's one thing that I do go over is that, you know, you need to make sure all your physicians are aware that you've had this type of cancer and this type of treatment. You need to communicate because maybe your screenings, your follow-ups will be different than the next person.
Yeah, unfortunately, I think most of us have the impression that the communication that occurs within the healthcare system is much more effective than it actually is. Unfortunately, most of the record systems still exist in silos. Mm-hmm. They don't necessarily communicate as much as you'd like. So you might go to your cardiologist and have lab work done, and they might send it over in the form of a note that goes back to the primary care office. Well, it's buried within 4 or 5 pages of text. There might be a lab result in there, but that's very easy to miss. And it also won't pop up on my computer screen if I look to see when your last cholesterol test was, because it disappeared into a consult note. So you don't have that information. You mentioned the importance of communication. There's an old adage, I forget who said it, but the gist of it is that the biggest problem with communication is the illusion that it has occurred. And that happens a lot.
I love that.
Yeah. That is really, really poignant. Yeah. You, what do you mean you didn't hear from my other doctor? I would assume,
right? Well, and most people come in and they go, well, you know, it's in there.
Yeah.
It's like, you probably saw it. Yeah, but there's thousands of pages of stuff in there. And we see a lot of people with similar problems too. So your story might sound a lot like somebody else. And it's quite easy to, you know, get those wires crossed. That's why we try to be diligent about entering the information and trying to get it in a way you can recall. But the services that Cancer Survivorship provides in terms of care summaries and the encouragement to communicate, that's infinitely important, because it's very easy for things to get lost in the shuffle with so many different doctors, so many different healthcare facilities that are all giving important information. And part of what we do in primary care is try to coordinate that and try to weave it back together.
Well, and the beautiful thing to remember for you guys listening is, we say this often, you are your best advocate.
Absolutely.
And so to communicate with the physicians and say, no, here, I had this last time, you know, I think I that's one of the hard things, right? Maybe is communicating with the physician, but it's important for them to advocate for themselves.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, for the most part, we don't want to put you through something you just had done. We just need the information for our medical decision-making to know what's the best path to recommend for you. And if I have that information, I have patients who, for example, like engineers, accountants, people that are very orderly anyway, they come in with basically these years of printouts that are organized, tabulated. They have tons of information. It's fantastic. You know, I don't have to go trying to search for things. I look at that and I know exactly, I have exactly the information I need to advise them. But the majority of us don't, you know, don't possess that same skill set and the energy and initiative to keep it updated. I had patients who'd come in, you know, 90 years old, and they'll say, well, you know, I had my tonsils out when I was 7 and it was at this place and this doctor did it.
I'm good.
I think we're okay on that one.
So what about cervical cancer screenings?
Okay. For cervical cancer screening, that has been an area where for the most part, the different organizations that make recommendations have coalesced together. Years ago, they used to say you should start when you're 18 years old. And what we found is that 18-year-old cervixes, not only is the likelihood incidence of cervical cancer extraordinarily small in a young group, you get a lot of falsely positive information, things that you would need to chase down, subject them to other types of screening tests. When I was young and in training, that was the recommendation. And we ended up doing a procedure called colposcopy, which is to evaluate abnormal pap smears a ridiculously large number of times on young college age girls. And the reason for that was because we figured out you shouldn't be doing this test on those younger girls. So now, for the most part, they've said don't start screening until you're 21 years old. Even that is a subject of some debate now. The American Cancer Society was the first of our large recommendation organizations to say 25 is really the sweet spot where you should be starting this. And the technology's changing. So historically, women had what we call annual exams. You would go into your doctor that involved undressing, getting up in stirrups, having a pap test done, and then oftentimes the bimanual exam, the part where the doctor uses their hands, and breast exams and all those things. Well, the information has led us away from that paradigm more and more. So what we're moving towards now, pap testing is still a valid and useful screen, but the interval's changed from annual to every 3 years through most of the organizations, because doing it annually produces too many falsely positive results without impacting the trajectory of the curve of mortality from cervical cancer. So those are the things you don't want to find. They're creating problems. So we moved every 3 years a while back. We changed the technology from the collection method has been done with a little brush and what's called a liquid-based testing mechanism now. But now what they found is that we can identify high-risk types of human papillomavirus, commonly called HPV, that are implicated in causing cervical cancer. And we've now found that you can use simply a high-risk swab, so literally like a long Q-tip, where you collect the fluid or the tissue samples from the vagina. And a woman can even collect that on her own. In different parts of the world, they're using self-collected swabs now as a common thing. And the studies show us that for sure they're not inferior to having a clinician collect it, and they may be superior in some of those studies. So literally just a swab that could be done. So no stirrups. The bimanual, the hand part of the examination hasn't been found to impact. We were trying to use that in part to screen for ovarian cancer. It wasn't effective as a modality for doing that. You might still need to have it done someday by a doctor, but that's going to be to evaluate a complaint or concern, not as a routine screening test. And so now with cervical cancer, you can either have the pap testing done every 3 years, in general between the ages of 21 and 65. There's some changes, and you know, if you've had a hysterectomy for non-cancerous or precancerous reasons, they don't need to recommend to continue that form of screening. Even if you had precancerous changes, but it's been a long time, typically 20, 25 years, you don't need to continue that screening. And if you've had normal screening for the prior decade as you approach the age of 65, you are likely eligible to have this conversation and exit from routine screening for cervical cancer. But I guess the summary of that is, on the horizon, it's likely that a woman will go to the doctor and not have to have all her clothes taken away from her when she does.
Wow.
And then you're in shock because they tell you you don't need a pep smear this year. So.
Yeah, that's very hard. Women have been fantastic about accepting screening and trying to be responsible and do great things. So when there's a conversation about, you know, every other year mammograms versus annual,
are you sure?
There's a lot. Whoa, that sounds like a bad idea, you know. So they look very closely at this. But every third year on cervical cancer screening, and actually with the high-risk HPV swabs I'm talking about, it's a five-year interval. So
sweet
technology. And we talk about that too, that the advancements are making is, and again, as a reminder to everybody, these are legitimate organizations. It's not like, let's just try 25. Maybe that's the, I mean, there's research that's done on these.
I mean, the government, of course, they're looking at it from a cost effectiveness lens. Does it work well? And is it effective? They're not trying to minimize things, but they will tend to have a less aggressive recommendation as a result of that process. But even the specialty societies and the cancer societies, they're finding that the evidence is saying, no, it's better to do less in this regard. So we want what's best for you. And it turns out less looks like, with this technology, it looks like less is more.
And again, for those that have had cervical cancer, that may not apply to you. There might be different screenings, so make sure that you talk to your healthcare provider, your oncologist. Okay, what about maybe common things between men and female, the colon cancer screening?
All right, so again, some evolution in the recommendations on that. There's been a little bit of disparity about who should be screened. The strongest body of evidence has said, similar to what we talked about with mammography, that 50 to 75 was the sweet spot for colon cancer screening. That number within the past year or so has decreased to 45 in general. Some debate about that. There are groups who think 45 is maybe too early still and the evidence not quite as good. But I think the majority of the groups, including the government's task force, now say you should start average risk screening at age 45. Again, if you have family members who had colon cancer, particularly if they developed it at an earlier age, talk to your doctor or healthcare provider about when the right time for you to start the screening is. But for the average risk person, and unfortunately, the American diet does not tend to be a particularly healthy one. We've struggled as a society with obesity, and that prevalence has been rising over the past few decades. Now, obesity is a strong part of the prediction of who gets colon cancer and several other types of cancer. So that has something to do with the way our recommendations evolve. But for the average risk person now, you want to start screening at age 45 and plan to continue through roughly age 75. Again, some groups will say if you have a particularly healthy 75-year-old who you think may live to be 90 or 100, you might not want to stop screening it at that point. Everybody's pretty consistent that by 85, it's not to say you have an expiration date, but we're not going to help you by further screening at that point.
Yeah. So here's the million-dollar question. You see these at-home colon cancer tests. And then, of course, we all know, those of us that are of age know the other screening test. What is what, and how do we determine, and is it okay to just do the at-home test, or where does all that land?
All right. There's a bunch out there, so stop me if I rattle on too long. But for starters, the Preventive Services Task Force, their general approach has been just do something. There's a whole bunch of things that could be acceptable. So the least expensive and a very effective way of doing this is something called FIT testing. That stands for fecal immunochemical testing. That's a stool sample specimen, but it's not given in a doctor's office. We give you typically one of two types of kits. They will either have something that's like a brush about the size of a pencil with bristles on the tip, where you kind of slosh it in the water near the bowel movement, or something that's more along the side, the lines of a thumb drive, that's about a toothpick-sized probe with grooves at the tip where you actually poke it into the bowel movement. You mail those things back in or drop them off at the lab. What they're testing for is human hemoglobin, the red blood cell oxygen-carrying protein that's in there. Now, studies or tests that we did in the past, which we called GWAIAC tests, which were looking for hidden blood in stool, they were previously just linked to hemoglobin, but not necessarily human hemoglobin. So we got a lot of results that were positive, but it's because people had red meat in their diet and they were picking up on the hemoglobin from the red meat in the diet. Well, as you might guess, in West Texas, when you tell your patients, we're going to do this test, just don't eat any red meat for a week or so. They oftentimes forget. They slip up. So we got a lot of false positives. We sent people for colonoscopies to investigate that, and oftentimes they said, no, there's nothing there. Well, that's a large part of why. So the FIT test has been a big step forward. Ballpark $25-ish dollar test to have it done. And in general, we recommend doing that annually. There are some other countries that do it every other year, and they don't tend to have more of a colon cancer burden than us with that strategy. So a cost-effective, easy test doesn't require any kind of bowel prep. So you mentioned colonoscopy. Mm. You know, that's where everybody's afraid of colonoscopy. They don't like the idea. But the reality of colonoscopy is that, assuming that it's covered by your insurance and you don't have major cost considerations associated with doing it, it's a very well-tolerated test. You sleep through it for the most part, don't know it happened, and then it's over right quick. But everybody remembers that night of 1,000 waterfalls the night before when you had to drink.
Boy, do we ever.
Yeah, so that's the main hang-up. And so the FIT testing allows you to not have a bowel prep. You mentioned Cologuard, and now there's an updated version of it that's coming called Cologuard Plus, which is a little bit better test characteristics on a similar process. That essentially means it's a test that's ordered. The company makes contact with you to coordinate the logistics of sending you the test kit that you'll need. You have a bowel movement, and they need like a full bowel movement. It's not a sample in there. And then you overnight it back to them, and they process it in their facility. That test actually pairs the FIT test that I mentioned with a DNA analysis of the stool. And if either of those components is positive, you'll get a report back that says it's positive, you need a colonoscopy. If they're both negative, you'll say, congratulations, it's negative, we should do this again in 3 years. So some people prefer that because of the 3-year screening interval. Currently, it's about a roughly $600-ish dollar test. It tends to be covered well by insurance, so if that's your preferred modality, that's an acceptable modality. The colonoscopy, if it's stone cold normal and you're at average risk and they don't make other recommendations, that can be a 10-year screening interval. So you might only have that done 2 or 3 times if it's normal. A lot of people like that if you have it done and you get a free pass from there. Now, if either of the studies we've mentioned prior to this turn up positive, you really shouldn't have that type of screening done in the future. You should do endoscopic screening with colonoscopy to chase that down. A couple little things worth mentioning. One that I said is the updated version of Cologuard offers some benefits in that regard. So you may hear about some new stool-based tests that offer good benefits and acceptability. And one thing that I'm really excited about that's recently FDA approved is a blood test to screen for colon cancer risk. Mm. That means no bowel prep, no nothing. I can lump it right in when we're checking your cholesterol or other things like that. And the test characteristics are quite similar to the others that I've mentioned in terms of how sensitive the test is, ability to detect it, and how specific did it get it right with the test. So that hasn't yet been integrated into the task force guidelines. I would tend to think there's a good chance they will because the test characteristics are similar and their prior approach has been, hey, whatever you'll do, just do it. The importance is do something. But I'm really excited about the notion of having blood test-based screening for colon cancer because it's just so much more acceptable to people.
Yeah, you're used to giving blood to have your cholesterol checked or your, you know, you're used to having that done.
A needle stick seems a lot more threatening than a night of diarrhea and having to drink all that stuff.
Absolutely.
Wow. Well, I'd like to take a second and go and let's talk about, we've talked about some women cancers. Let's talk about some men here. Let's talk about prostate.
All right. Well, prostate cancer is... That is a challenge. It is, it's truly a challenge. And the reason is because prostate cancer is really a spectrum of illness. There's the kind of cancer that might strike a man in their 40s or 50s and may be more aggressive in its behavior, more likely to spread to bone, potentially shorten their lives, right? That's the kind we're terrified of. And that's the reason we try so hard to have good screening programs. There's another type of prostate cancer that just means you didn't die when you were young. So there's good data that have been done from studies where people died, men died from an accidental death, nothing cancer related, but underwent an autopsy. And what they have found that the prevalence of prostate cancer closely mirrors the decade of life, essentially. So that when you're in your 50s, if you go looking for it, there's about a 50-50 chance you can find it in there, even though most of those men aren't destined to die from prostate, or wouldn't have been destined to die from prostate cancer. As you get older, like in your 70s, is more than an 80% chance it's in there if you go looking for it. But again, later in the screening interval, most of those men have the type of prostate cancer that grows slowly, that is unlikely to spread, less likely to shorten their life. So those are the men that we're cautious about at the end of the screening age recommendation, because you're more likely to find something that we might characterize as a false alarm. But it's still, once you know prostate cancer is in there, you don't sleep on that well. So men are more likely to choose, you know, potentially a more aggressive pathway. And those pathways can have some concerns related to the treatments that you might employ to do that. Now, something that's happened that I think is a very positive development in this spectrum. So for a while, let me just summarize. The government said from 2012 to 2018, they said, PSA is not a good test. Don't do the PSA, right? Meanwhile, the urologists and others said, no, it's a good test. You should do this test, right? And so we had pretty significant dichotomy between different organizations that are looking at data and making recommendations. I should say that most of those westernized countries with organized healthcare systems, they still don't employ PSA. Some of the European countries, though, the pendulum is swinging more and it's closer in alignment with what the American Urology Association says. So the recommendation now in general is if you're at average risk, and so just if you have a family history of prostate cancer or if you're of African-American ancestry, those groups tend to have higher prostate cancer risks, or if you're just otherwise known to have an elevated risk, then again, this is an average risk conversation. Talk with your doctor specifically and likely you'll be screened earlier. But the more aggressive groups are saying, you ought to consider having a PSA test done somewhere around 45 or so, like a baseline. Urologists often like to know where we stand before we get aggressive with this. And the government's task force says that if you decide you want to do this screen, 55 to 69 is probably the window where there's greatest benefits. The urologists have a little broader window of 50 to 70 for average risk screening for men. Over 70, you start to run the risk of finding things you would have rather not known about. So again, it's an individualized decision when it's time to stop screening, but that's a conversation you want to have with your healthcare provider specifically at that time. But I think the sort of good news about this is that now the guidelines, even from the urology groups, they say if you get a normal abnormal PSA, the first thing to do, get another PSA. Let's just see, make sure, verify that it was correct before you get excited about that. Sometimes there, because the problem with PSA is that while it's specific to prostate tissue, it's not specific to prostate cancer. And so there are other conditions that a man might get, like prostate hypertrophy or an infection of the prostate or other things that could cause some elevations. They don't tend to cause sustained high elevations. So a lot of times the doctor will choose to monitor it over a period of time with a shorter interval for rescreening. They may want to do rectal exam to check and see, you know, what they can feel on the prostate. Urologists in general will do that pretty routinely because for the most part, by the time you've made it to the Supreme Court there of treatment in that regard, they want to do that and the patients expect for that to be done. But it's not 100% of the time, so don't be afraid of going to your doctor because it doesn't necessarily mean you're going to have to see Dr. Jellyfinger. But what's happened that's an evolution now is once you have a higher number, a lot of men, particularly if they're older, they're choosing to do what's called active surveillance, which essentially is just shorter intervals, closer observation to see what's going on, what's the trend. And for a lot of men, they'll stay in an active surveillance pattern and it's not aggressive enough that they end up needing more aggressive treatment. Yeah.
Sometimes they use those words watchful waiting, right?
Correct.
That's kind of interchangeable. So if you guys are listening and you go, but mine said watchful waiting, it's the same thing.
Yeah. And that's something that is easier to sleep on because somebody's paying attention to it. Somebody's following it. Somebody who knows a lot more about it than you do, right? So mm-hmm. as long as you go to those follow-up visits, then that's another way to screen for and follow up with that. The other thing that to me is a really nice advantage is the role of MRI in evaluation of prostate troubles has come a lot, has progressed a lot. So there's data now that suggests that if you have these abnormalities, that if you have an MRI done prior to a biopsy, so historically a prostate biopsy has been around 12 different biopsies from different portions of the prostate to try to sample the whole thing and find. It's a little bit more of a, I'm not going to say, it's not exactly a needle in a haystack, but you're going at it blind and checking several different areas to check for it. With the ability of the improvements in MRI now, they're typically able to biopsy three or four places instead of a dozen places, so improvement in that regard. And their diagnostic yields, their likelihood of finding that you have it, is much higher. So less is more probably in this case. If we have good information and can do a targeted pursuit of a potential abnormality based on excellent images, then a man's much more likely to get good information that would help to guide the decision-making about, you know, whether surgery or radiation or other treatments would be appropriate for them.
Do you find, too, that with the PSA test, that kind of falls into that category, too, of, as you were saying, like, just do something? You know, it's like, it's kind of like the Cologuard. It's the this, it's the that. It's just, we're trying to at least, guys are hard-headed. And, you know, you always hate to hear that late stage, you know, first diagnosis of prostate cancer and that they'd never had a PSA, they'd never had a DRE or anything. Is that?
I mean, in general, men don't, you know, jump in the car and head to the doctor very easily. They're frequently drawn in by their spouse or significant other or that sort of thing. Now, prostate cancer, there's definitely genetic components to it. So if prostate cancer runs in your family, you really don't want to ignore that, you know, so probably some form of screening is appropriate. If you know your family history and there's not a lick of prostate cancer in it anywhere, and you don't have African-American ancestry, for example, their risks might be lower. It might not be Russian roulette to decide, I don't want to do the PSA test. But that's a conversation you should have. I think the urologist, for the most part, would err on the side of men who reach a certain age. Maybe you ought to check it at least once and see. And the other thing we're doing now is looking, using the PSA result to guide how much more looking you need to do. So if a man has a result that's 0.2, checking it next year is not likely to help a lot. So maybe you don't recheck it for 3 to 5 years in a person that has a nice low number. But if their number is 3 or 4, that's sort of closer to the number that gets attention, they're likely going to want to repeat that within 6 months or a year to see what's the trajectory there. And so a little bit more thoughtful decision-making with regard to how you target screening interventions is helpful in the world of prostate cancer screening.
Is there any other screenings that men, specifically for men?
In terms of cancer prevention screenings that are like unique to organs you commonly only see in men, not so much. Testicular cancer, even though you hear about it, by and large, we're going to cure about 90% of testicular cancer by the time it becomes symptomatic. And so when you have a disease state where the treatments are really good and the outcomes are quite good, it's pretty hard to prove benefits from a screening intervention. So men everywhere breathed a sigh of relief when we stopped recommending testicular self-exam, which were uncomfortable and, you know, not very useful. And by the way, since we're mentioning self-exams, breast self-examination, the pendulum has swung away from that. For a while, it was, hey, you should check them on a regular basis systematically. The data really show us that did not help anything with regard to breast cancer, but it created more worry, more biopsies, more procedures. If a woman comes into a doctor and says, I think there's something wrong with my breast, we're not just going to do an exam and say, you're wrong, it's fine. For the most part, that's going to lead to a diagnostic mammography process or diagnostic breast evaluation. And then, you know, doctors don't want to fail to find something of potentially of that much consequence. So they tend to be a little bit more aggressive with those recommendations. But from all of those efforts, breast cancer mortality did not improve, just a lot more procedures and a lot more worry. And so that's why they now say, not just do it if you want to, but in general, breast self-examination creates more harm than benefit. So you probably shouldn't be doing that. Just make sure you're going in and having these conversations and visits about proper screening.
Going to those visits is the most important thing.
Yeah, for sure.
What about lung cancer screening?
Okay, well, that was the next one I was going to mention since we all have lungs, right?
So, we do.
lung cancer kills more of us than any other type of cancer. And so we've been looking for a long, long time to find something that worked well. How could you screen? So chest x-rays, collecting sputum samples and examining it in groups that were at higher risk never seemed to make much of a difference here. But now we do have something. So we can use, everybody's familiar with CT scans, which is a form of cross-sectional imaging where you hop in there. It's quick, and the computer takes a whole bunch of different, essentially like x-rays, and assembles them into a three-dimensional image of your insides. And they can do that with very thin cuts and see closely through the lungs. With lung cancer, so the trouble with having just regular CTs all the time is that CT scans have ionizing radiation, and overall cumulative lifetime exposure to ionizing radiation increases cancer risk. And so if we said, Ryan, you're a smoker and you're of a certain age, so if I put you in and did standard CT scans, I could find something, but I'd actually be more likely to cause lung cancer because of all of that radiation exposure. Now the machines all have what are called low-dose algorithms. So they can do a sort of quick spin that gets a very good look at the lung still, but has minimal ionizing radiation exposure. And so for certain groups, specifically for smokers between the ages of 50 and 80 who have at least a 20-pack year smoke history in general. So pack years, what that means is on average, so you could get a 20-pack year by smoking one pack a day for 20 years, or if you smoked half a pack a day for 40 years or two packs a day for 10 years, your cumulative smoking risk is higher. So in general, people that have 20-pack year or higher smoking risk and they're either current smokers or have quit within the past 15 years, and they're in that age range, they benefit from an annual low-dose CT scan. Quick, it's easy. You don't have to do any kind of fasting or prep or anything like that for it, but it's something we have to order and coordinate for you, and then they look closely at that. The other thing that's important to mention, though, because a lot of times smoking comes with collateral damage. People might have severe heart disease or obstructive pulmonary diseases or other things that would make them bad candidates for surgical interventions that would be necessary to change the natural history of an evolving lung cancer. And so I have that conversation with my patient, and they say, well, yeah, I mean, if I found it, I would do something about it. That's the right candidate. But if they say, no way, doc, I'm not going under the knife no matter what, or if I know, if they crack their chest, they're likely to die from consequences of the illness or may not have the strength to, those people are poor candidates. So again, you have to have the conversation to decide who's likely to benefit. But if you're a smoker between 50 and 80 and you've smoked a fair amount over the years and you're otherwise in reasonably good health, that population gets clear benefits. Sometimes we talk about the number needed to screen, and oftentimes it takes thousands of people to screen to prevent an additional death from a given disease state. The data for lung cancer screening, it's only a couple of hundred people or so that need to be screened to prevent another death. So there's a lot of opportunity in. This is a newer recommendation, but we're still like quite a bit lower. We're screening somewhere around 15 to 20% of the population that could potentially benefit from screening. Now, that would include many of the people who are not going to choose that path anyway, but that number needs to come up for us to realize those benefits from lung cancer screening.
I remember when low-dose CT scans for lung cancer first came on the scene, and it was like cash only. You know, insurances weren't covering it because it was so new. And I'm so glad that it's becoming more and more recommended. It's now part of all the task force. It is now, you know, covered on most insurances, I believe.
The data is fantastic. In general, I mentioned the Preventive Services Task Force, but one of the benefits of the Affordable Care Act from now 15-ish years old now was that if something gets a B or better recommendation from the task force, meaning there's good evidence that there's at least a moderate net benefit, or there's evidence that it's quite beneficial and able to be tolerated, that insurance is going to cover those things. We know the government entity insurance will cover, but the private insurance tends to follow that as well. It's in their best financial interest to choose to screen and find and prevent things. So in general, coverage will be good once it gets a recommendation, and it does have that recommendation. So for the most part, if they have coverage of some form, then it's pretty easy to expect. Initially, this was a controversial recommendation because one of the challenges in the early days was I didn't have a way in my electronic record to say I want the low-dose scan. It wasn't a discreetly orderable item, just chest CT. And so I'd have to put a memo or note that says, use a low-dose protocol. Well, also, many of the imaging centers around, they were not as high in the queue as the hospital, so they didn't have the low-dose algorithm programmed into their equipment. But they wouldn't tend to say, nah, we're not going to do it. They'd just go ahead and do a normal one. Well, as I mentioned, that ionizing radiation is a big problem. And so, but now everybody has it. Everybody has a low-dose algorithm. Everybody's electronic record system has a way to order for that low-dose algorithm. And so as long as you can document that you had the conversation I just alluded to about the risks and benefits and their willingness to undergo further things, if we order it, it's going to get done.
Wow.
So that brings us to skin cancer screening.
Yeah, skin cancer screening has been, you know, somewhat more controversial through the years, surprisingly so, because first off, skin cancer comes in multiple varieties. The most common ones that we see are commonly called basal cell carcinomas or squamous cell carcinomas. Most people who get those, they're going to sit in the given area. They're going to grow. They're going to get gradually uglier, perhaps uncomfortable. They're less likely to spread to different parts of the body and kill you. It's not a never phenomenon. Some neglected squamous cell cancers once in a while will do that. But by and large, we collectively refer to those as non-melanoma skin cancers because those are the kind that are more locally problematic and with advancing age and sun exposure over the course of a lifetime. But that's the kind of stuff where you go to the doctor and they go, well, let me cut that one off. Let me freeze that one. Mm-hmm. Those sorts of things. The one we're all terrified of is melanoma. And there's debate about what should be done in that regard. In general, lining people up and saying, you know what, you're not going to get out of Yankee Stadium until you take off your clothes and we look at you and find things. The data say we don't find a lot more melanomas. And you'll find that you'll increase your diagnosis, but it hasn't changed the mortality curve associated with it. So melanoma continues to be very hard to treat once it's diagnosed. And there's different types of melanomas as well. So there's different visitation. But for most people, the advice is common sense. For starters, limit your sun exposure. So particularly if you're fair-skinned and Caucasian, we just are not nearly liberal enough with sunscreen application, with efforts to cover the skin and to protect ourselves. So that is by far the best strategy, is prevention up front. But if, let's say, you had your misspent youth and you laid out and tried to get tan, even though it was a nearly impossible, I've told my patients for years that I figured out early on I had only three choices, white, pink, and red. Those were going to be my pigment colors.
Amen to that.
But if you know, like most of us, got some sunburns along the way in childhood and that sort of thing, we have some risks associated with that, even from that. So you want to be paying attention to what's going on with the skin. As we get older, more stuff that isn't cancer but might look kind of like it pops up on the skin. So most patients beyond midlife, it's probably reasonable to be paying attention in the mirror. And when you see your doctor for regular health care, have a to-do list. I like my patients to keep it on their notes on their phone or something like that so that they'll remember, because otherwise we tend to forget. We get caught up in treating our blood pressure or having diabetes care or other stuff like that. And these are the things that easily, you know, sort of fall to the side. So that's another little appeal that I will make. Historically, we talked about going to the doctor to have a physical. That term, short for physical exam, implies that me breaking out my reflex hammer and my stethoscope and a tuning fork and some other things that I might pull out of the drawer is going to save your life. And the data say that's really not the key part. You know, examine what you need to examine. But the key thing is these conversations. What types of cancer screening? Cardiovascular screenings. preventable diseases with immunizations that we can give you and keep those things updated. That's where the big bang for your buck is in what we now commonly refer to as health maintenance visits. And if you don't go to your doctor for a health maintenance visit and you just try to pile it in on top of blood pressure and diabetes and cholesterol and depression and ingrown toenails and all that, there's going to be no time to have a thoughtful conversation about cancer screening and other sorts of things. So my encouragement is go to your doctor or healthcare provider with the specific agenda of, let's talk about how I can live longer, not just from managing diseases we know I have, but identifying things that I might be at risk for but might not have been thinking about.
So how often should people be doing that type of visit?
Well, it varies a little bit person to person. Annual is not a bad interval. There are certain things that maybe it's a little bit too much, but you don't have to do every one of these conversations every year. As I'm sure you figured out when you go to a doctor, the agenda is pretty compressed and the window of opportunity can be kind of tight. Mm-hmm. So having a conversation where it's like, all right, this year we're talking cancer screenings. Let's make sure I'm current and up to date. Next year, let's talk about diet and exercise and cardiovascular health and other things. So the annual screening is nice, but probably if you would deliberately make a point to do that at least every 2 years, we're likely to be able to spend more time talking about ways to stay healthy and maintain that, you know, over the lifespan.
Very great idea and tip. Keep a note on your phone, you know. You're listening to this podcast, pull your phone out and add some things onto your to-do list.
Phones, you know, like for years, I'll tell patients, go home, keep a blood pressure log, write down your logs. And people faithfully do that, or blood sugars or other things. And, you know, half the time or more, they forget it. They leave it at home. They don't have that information available when they're here. So I tell patients, ideally, and there's a lot of apps that are suitable for this for certain things like blood pressure or other things. But even if they're not, just the simple note apps on your phone or the photos, like use your phone's camera, take a picture of anything you're logging periodically, because there's a pretty good chance you're going to forget it by the appointment time, but nobody forgets their phone. How miserable would that be to sit in a doctor's office with no phone?
No solitaire to play, no games to play.
No searching the internet, shopping. Is there anything else that we should be aware of as far as screening?
Those are the main things. My main point is do something, because apathy kills. You know, if we just sit around and let life happen, or we get too busy and we never prioritize this, it's not that we can't help you at some point, but it's much better to be proactive than reactive on most of these things. If we can get in front of it and help you with healthy behaviors and ways to decrease risks over the lifetime, you're much more likely to live a healthy and active life as a senior than you might be if you just let nature take its course and never seem to get around doing it. So go to your doctor specifically for the purpose of having a health maintenance evaluation with no competing agenda.
Okay. Good idea. Just a couple other things. Blood pressure. How often should we be screened for blood pressure issues?
So the recommendations vary a little bit. If somebody has normal blood pressure and they go to the doctor annually and we check it using proper techniques, then that's probably adequate or reasonable screening. If you know, hey, everybody in my family gets it by a certain age, then you need to check it, because, you know, we call high blood pressure the silent killer. And it doesn't tend to produce symptoms. So the fact that you feel just fine is great. People all the time come in and say, oh, well, you know, I see you're getting 150 over 90 there, but my pressure usually runs 120 over 80. It's like, well, that's what it ran when you were 25 the last time you checked it, but you're not there anymore. And right. Yeah, but I feel fine and all that sort of stuff. So knowledge is power. And a lot of times insurance companies will help with this, but even if they don't, it's $30 or so to buy a good quality device that does this automatic. So no stethoscope in the ears. It just goes on the arm. Typically, the upper arm cuffs tend to be more reliable than the wrist cuffs. That's not universally true, but in general, closer to the heart with a properly fitted upper arm cuff. And then the technique matters too. So when you have your blood pressure checked, you want to be seated in a chair where your back is supported. Both feet are resting flat on the floor, so not crossed, not dangling on a doctor's exam table. And just the process of uprighting your posture and holding yourself up will raise your blood pressure some. You want to be in that position for at least 5 minutes or so before you check your blood pressure. Our bodies raise blood pressure naturally when we stand because the brain doesn't take a joke. It wants to get its blood at all time, and it takes more pressure when you're standing to get it there. So do that. If you smoke, don't smoke for at least 30 minutes or so before then. Ideally, never smoke. If there's anything I should say on a cancer prevention podcast, it's run from tobacco in any form, right? If you drink coffee or, you know, have to get your morning wake up, stay away from that too, because the caffeine in there will raise blood pressure some. If your bladder is full, that will raise blood pressure. So you don't necessarily have to run to the restroom right before checking it. But when you have a full bladder, that's not the time to check it. It's going to be maybe 3 to 5 points higher just because of that. So if you do all these things, you truly can help yourself. And the reality is everybody knows it. Doctor's offices rarely get this right because they're busy moving people through there. So you want to be deliberate. Most of the time, if I get somebody with initial borderline or elevated readings, the first order of business is homework. Get one of these devices, do it like this, check it regularly, keep a log. You just want to know about it because if we catch it early on and treat it before your blood vessels have to be exposed to years of higher pressure, you're much less likelihood to have those adverse cardiovascular events like heart attack or stroke or, God forbid, sudden cardiac death.
The other two diseases, what about cholesterol and diabetes? When should we start screening for those?
So in general, for the average risk person, you want to be checking cholesterol by age 40, 35 for some groups before that. So most of the time people will have it checked. Now, if you have other risk factors, if you are diabetic or have high blood pressure or struggle with obesity, those might be reasons to check it earlier on in the process. And so just getting to know that early on helps. Now, we have risk calculators where there's some modulation going on in that field as well, where we try to predict how high somebody's cardiovascular risk of having one of those major adverse events that I mentioned will be over the next decade. We've used data that are improving over time, and you're going to hear about something called the PREVENT calculator, which is sort of this next iteration that incorporates issues related to social determinants and the factors that affect us in other aspects as well. But they tend to be relatively easy calculations that when we have that cholesterol information, we can do. Diabetes screening, again, if somebody struggles with overweight or obesity, they have higher risks. If there's certain conditions that are associated with insulin resistance, like polycystic ovaries or other things, if you have a strong family history of diabetes, we screen those people earlier. But in general, if they're obese or overweight, we're checking that at least every 3 years or so, as long as it's remaining normal in that time frame.
And one last thing that I can think of, what about bone densities? How often should we be getting a bone density test?
So bone density can get really complicated. The general recommendation is by age 65, if you haven't had a reason to screen earlier, you should have what's called a DEXA done, which is an X-ray type study to assess bone mineral density. If it's stone cold normal and you're in good shape, there's no real value to doing it again quickly. Probably 10 years or so is a reasonable interval to repeat that. But if you have lots of people with fractures in the family, certain people with chronic diseases that relate to like kidneys or sometimes problems with vitamin D metabolism. Vitamin D has been another topic that people are really excited about in recent years. For the most part, the average risk person doesn't need to have their vitamin D screened or monitored. And you don't get great benefits. If you know you're on the low side or you have chronic kidney disease and there's some concerns about it, lower dose, regular, daily, or every other day replacements tend to be a better strategy than the large intermittent doses of replacing vitamin D. But there's been all kinds of study in vitamin D, and for the most part, we don't find great beneficial outcomes. There might be some improvement, some signal in the data about fewer autoimmune illnesses. So if those things run strongly in the family, perhaps keeping your vitamin D a little propped up on the high side might be helpful. So a lot of things you can do, but for the most part, going crazy with a million different supplements and vitamins and things like that don't tend to give us measurable benefits in that regard. Sometimes related to diseases, your doctor might make different specific recommendations. You certainly want to follow those, but spending, you know, half of your life savings on a regimen of diets and stuff, hoping it's a fountain of youth, yeah. It's generally not.
Right.
It's expensive and wasteful.
Yeah. Well, it can be. No, yeah. I'm not saying
can be
all circumstances sure. and never, but you know, for the most part, I see people that come in with a list that's five times as long of vitamins as, you know, exercise or anything else that they might have done. So,
yeah. What vitamin does this? What vitamin does that? It can be confusing.
A lot to learn from today's episode. This is one of those ones that more than likely you may need to go back and re-listen to.
Yes. And, you know, the most important thing is, you know, this was for the average person. Mm-hmm. If you've had cancer, you know, you want to make sure you talk to your oncologist. Make sure that you're getting the correct screenings for your particular cancer.
That's right. That's right.
Thank you, Dr. Young. And that brings us to our last segment. We are sponsored by the Auto Inc. family. And would you share an Auto Inc. inspiring moment with our listeners?
Sure. I guess I'll start by saying I've inspired Auto Inc. a few times myself. So
had some nice rides, huh?
Yeah. You know, I guess my inspiring moment, I'm going to say, is my mom. My mom is she's facing multiple myeloma now. She's been in treatment for the past several years. And she's one of those, I'm not going to say, you know, crusty, but she isn't going to gripe much. If she could stomach it and tolerate it, she'll do so. In fact, the way this came to light is I went to visit and she just had debilitating back pain that she had, you know, sort of minimized and said it was casual. Like, no, this is not normal. We have to get some imaging done. And she did. And there's a big myeloma lesion in the middle of her spine. So she ends up having surgery for that. And getting on initial treatments, she's now sort of on round three of different types of chemo, but several years into this illness and still just, I talk to her most every day. She loves my dog because me walking my dog is an opportunity to catch up with my mom and dad who are both chronically ill and they, you know, my mom's never met the dog, but she's the dog's biggest fan.
She loves it when you take the dog for a walk.
She does, but I just really appreciate that. She will rarely ever say, boy, today was terrible. You know, once in a while it truly is, but she just has such a, you know, such a strong heart and I'm really proud of her in the course of that. So that's my inspiring moment.
That's so awesome. Absolutely. You know, special moms out there and, you know, I wish her the best going through treatment, but you know, what a great son for being there, encouraging her to go talk to her doctor.
Well, I try, you know, occasionally I end up being the son/doctor, but I try pretty hard not to interfere too much, but she has wonderful care there. And they very much appreciate her. I kind of have a casual relationship with her oncologist where I chat to. And then interestingly enough, several of our Texas Tech Amarillo graduates actually practice at her hospital in Central California there. Oh, so some connections world. Related to training as well.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Just never know how that will come back around.
Huh? As a side note, Texas Tech, is the right word, say, produces fantastic physicians, just as you said, you know, they're all over the United States.
We certainly hope. You know, one of the things that obviously I'm nine kinds of biased related to this, but I think Texas Tech as an institution, it was founded because of a problem. It was difficult to get people to locate and practice in West Texas. We know that if you train people closer to there, they're more likely to practice there. Yes. And so a large percentage of the physicians in this area and many of the healthcare providers of different types, they got their training through Texas Tech and they've stayed here to practice. I think the local values that are just part of being an Amarillo, you know, you can go anywhere, particularly in the South, and everybody says, oh, people are so sweet and so nice. But it really is true in the Panhandle. We just have a different pace of life, a different yes. type of person yep. that kind of, you know, smells the flowers, appreciates things, and shares their appreciation. There's a certain ruggedness to living, you know, in this part of the country. And I think people are... they're kind, they're strong, they're nice. It's a wonderful place to live. And so woven into that recruitment process for the medical school and the health science center is you got to come see this place and then compare it to what you find in the big cities and other places. Right. Mm-hmm. And we do oftentimes find people who see that and value it, and that ends up making some truly fantastic young doctors and nurses and others who come through here and train here and then stay in our communities. Just, it's a really big blessing to the community that we have this resource here.
Absolutely.
You know, Dr. Young, thank you so much for what you've done for our foundation in the past and being here on the podcast. I know our listeners are going to learn a lot. What a great episode, Ron.
It is. You know, I say this often, and I truly mean it.
A broken record.
We learn a lot, you know?
We do.
We learn a lot. And so a lot of people, you know, there's a lot to take away from this. So make sure and share this. It's not all for someone who's been through cancer to learn from this episode. You just listen to all of that. Share this with your family. Share it with your friends. Make sure they know it is important to get your screenings. It's very important to stay communicative with your physician and your care team and your family itself.
Take those notes to your physician and make that wellness check soon.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah, this is everyone's episode. So cancer survivors benefit, but the rest of us benefit from being involved in our own health maintenance and care.
Absolutely. 100%. Couldn't say it better. That sounds like a good point to leave on. Well, thank you guys for listening. Thank you guys for being with us this year. We've got some exciting things in our next episode to talk about what's coming up for next year. Come by and see us at our new facility at 1732 Hagee. Get involved in one of our classes, and then make sure and join us next time for another great episode of Beyond the Ribbon.
Thanks again for listening to Beyond the Ribbon. We'd like to extend a special thanks to the Auto Inc. family of dealerships, as they have supported the 24 Hours in the Canyon Cancer Survivorship Center since 2016. For more information on the Cancer Survivorship Center, please visit our website at 24survivorship.org.